Chris Sarah's breakthrough approach to learning while he was the principal of the Cherbourg State School in southeast Queensland won him the ear of some politicians, and it also earned him some critics. He went on to found the Stronger, Smarter Institute for Indigenous Education in partnership with the Queensland University of Technology. But his contract was terminated 18 months before it was due to expire. His book, Good Morning, Mr. Sarah, sets out his Stronger, Smarter philosophy, the core principles being strong leadership, personal engagement, and of resetting the paradigm of low expectations. Chris Sarah is speaking with Rico Adrin, and he started by asking Chris, who was the teacher who had the most effect on him as a young fella?
It's a good question. There are a few teachers who come to mind as my favourite teachers. I think I wrote about it in the book, a guy called Mr. Bolch, who was my teacher in grade 4 and 5. And he was pretty special for some pretty simple reasons. You know, we'd always known about Mr. Bolch as being the strict and grumpy teacher.
Yeah.
But there was a moment where all of that changed. You know, we certainly perceived him as strict and grumpy. But in many ways, he was firm but fair. I wrote about playing cricket one day and we were like just black kids, you know, turning up to play cricket, and we had the pad on with no shoes on.
Yo.
And I was getting a blister on the back of my foot, and Mr. Bolch said, "Oh, what's wrong?" I said, "Oh, sir, I got this blister on my foot." And he took his hanky out and he put it in behind my leg because he didn't want the blister to get any worse. And for me, it was kind of like almost like an intimate moment that felt really strange for me. And there was a kind of closeness that I'd never felt with any other teacher before. But it was something, there was something about that, just that single gesture, which he had forgotten about it was kind of, didn't register that strongly with him at all. But it said to me that he really cared about me. And just because of that, I never ever played up for Mr. Bolch anymore because I respected him.
Yeah.
I tried to be the best that I could be for him in class and work really hard, just because he had signaled that he cared for me. So one small gesture can be worth a lot. And I try to get teachers to understand this. You know, sometimes as teachers we can make a throwaway comment that will make a kid feel good or feel bad, and the power and the magic in those exchanges in schools between a teacher and a child is that sometimes people remember it forever, you know. Like all of your listeners, pretty much all of them, I'm sure, would remember a teacher that they had, and they'd remember something that they said to them. You know, your listeners could be 80 or 90 years old, but I pretty much reckon they'd remember a teacher who made them feel good or made them feel no good.
Yep. Chris, with your strong and smart philosophy, and even in the book, Good Morning, Mr. Sarah, leadership is a constant theme throughout.
No, look, I think there's a lot of books being written about leadership, and I think there's a lot of steps that have been articulated by people who've done lots of research. But I think in some ways, I like to think that I could crystallize it down to one when it comes to school leadership. And I remember very well moments when, if I was going to have a meeting with a parent who was grumpy about something that was going on, I would explicitly stop and just stare my own face in the mirror and just stop for a moment and imagine and say, what if this was my own mother that I was going to talk to? Or what if this was my own big sister I was going to talk to about her children, my nephews and nieces?
Yeah.
And if it was, how would I want them spoken to? How would I want them regarded? How would I want them dealt with in a kind of way? And so in a sense, if you can do that, then you make it personal. And when you can make it personal, the question shifts quite dramatically from, you know, what do we do with these kids, to what would I want done if this was my child? And I think it's probably one of the more significant kind of things that I wanted to come through in the book. So if there are school principals reading it, if there was just one message I'd want them to take, it would be that, to take their work seriously and to not be afraid to make it personal, you know. So, and if you can do that and think about things in that sort of way, you know, that is, if you're dealing with your own family or your own children, how would you want them spoken to or attended to? The response is quite dramatic. You often, you know, I had to be conscious of almost like taking off your ego and hanging it on the door before you walk out the door, and not letting that get in the way. Because sometimes when you're meeting with parents who are really grumpy or fired up, or teachers who are fired up, you can't afford to let yourself be hurt or injured by some of the things that they might have to say or some of the criticisms. But rather, you've got to understand that they're here, and it's a good thing that they're here, whether they're grumpy or what.
Yep.
They're here because they love their child and they want the best for their child. And we're there being paid to be in that relationship because we want to make a difference to the lives of children. And when you can get to that point and understand that, you can get on with business pretty well.
This is a tough question, but is ingrained racism the single biggest problem with regards to Indigenous disadvantage in schools?
Look, I think when you wash it all away, that's probably the thing that's at the core of the challenges that we face in terms of the gap that exists in education. You know, and it's something that people don't like to hear, and sometimes we cringe or cower down when we hear references to racism. But it's not a useful response. The most useful and more productive response is to stare this in the face and understand that, you know, it's racism that enables us, or it's a kind of sense of belief that there are a bunch of Australians who are inferior. It's that kind of thinking and that kind of belief that enables us to tolerate or endure a circumstance that in which for decades Aboriginal children have been left so far behind. It's that kind of thinking that enables politicians to not really be too concerned about Aboriginal children in remote communities and the fact that they're failing. It's that kind of thinking that lets regional directors and school principals accept all sorts of excuses from teachers and other principals about why there's such chronic failure, when ultimately there's really no excuse for the chronic failure that we're enduring in education. You know, if this was a, you know, if there was a small white community that was somewhat remote and there was the same levels of chronic failure or lack of investment in that particular school, there would be an outrage, you know, people would be outraged. And look, I'm not trying to be controversial or anything. I'm just trying to be honest there that we really need to just confront those sort of circumstances and just deal with them. And it's almost like we need to, you know, particularly if we're talking about remote communities, it's almost like for a moment we've got to forget that these are Aboriginal children that we're talking about and understand that these are Australian children that we're talking about and think about what is good enough for those Australian children. And as we decide or make decisions about what is good enough and what should be the, what are the targets in terms of education and well-being and all of that, and as we set off in pursuit of the delivery of those targets, it's at that point then we have to remember that these are Aboriginal children, and that would bring various complexities. So we can't just assume that we would set off to deliver education in the same way that we would for white children, but understand that there are complexities that come with being Aboriginal, and we have to remember that.
What brought about the memoir, and what did it offer that wasn't already told in Strong and Smart Towards a Pedagogy for Emancipation, Education for First Peoples?
The first book I had published that you referred to, Strong and Smart Pedagogy for the Emancipation of First Peoples, it's quite a mouthful. It was published by Routledge in London, and basically it's a scaled-down version of my PhD thesis. But, you know, to be honest, I like the second book better. The first book is a high-order intellectual piece that is written in some ways just to prove that I can write and be in that kind of high-order intellectual space.
Yeah.
And the language in that first book published by Routledge is not as accessible. And it's one of the things that I've developed a sense of contempt for the world of academia, and that it's, you know, we can, in the world of academia, we can use big words and think that we become so important that we become disconnected or alienated from just the general society. And I don't think that that's a good thing, you know. So I've worked around professors and other academics who walk up and down the hallways thinking that they are so important because they've written some books and they have the title of professor in front of their name. But the truth is, you know, particularly in education, you put any one of those people in a school and get them to run it, they'd probably wet their pants after half a day.
Yeah.
So in many ways, they're quite useless. Which brings me to the point of the second book. It's written in a much more conversational tone, and some of the feedback that I like the most is that it's accessible. You know, that it's like sitting down having a yarn with me, people will say, and they usually get through it pretty quickly. Yet the messages in the book, Good Morning, Mr. Sarah, are pretty much the same as the messages in the first book published by Routledge. But it's much more accessible, you know, and there are some quite sophisticated and complex messages bound up in the stories or the yarns in the Good Morning, Mr. Sarah book. And I really hope that people can get a hold of them. So it's pretty important. And I must admit, I enjoyed writing the second one much more. And interestingly, I thought, you know, when I wrote it, it is a memoir to some extent. And at the end of the book, I explained that it was, you know, I just turned 45. It's way too early to be writing a memoir. But the time is now to be injecting a way of thinking about Aboriginal policy reform. And the reason I wrote it was because I've become very disillusioned with these kind of big stick approaches that were so expensive and so ineffective. You know, in the book, I talked a lot about my misgivings about the way the Northern Territory intervention unraveled. And it kind of came out in a way that really was dishonourable to Aboriginal people. It really, in a way, that undermined the humanity of Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. And I wanted people to understand that when we undermine the humanity of Aboriginal people, we undermine our own humanity, and all of us lose. Not to mention that those sort of big stick approaches are dramatically ineffective, dramatically expensive, and in no way sustainable. When my experience with the Stronger, Smarter approach was that it didn't cost as much, but it was anchored on positive relationships and a belief in the humanity of people and honouring that humanity, and coming at it with a strength-based approach in which we could sniff the breeze and see what was good and what was working and invest in those sorts of strategies. And at the same time, challenge Aboriginal Australians to stand up and set ourselves free, and at the same time challenge white Australians to understand the complexity and understand that it's not only Aboriginal people that are broken in this relationship. White Australia has some things that they need to fix as well.
Chris, what can we read into Sherberg hitting speed bumps after you moved on, and now this year the split with QUT?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think on the question of leaving Sherberg, lots of people ask me, and it's a valid question, what happened to Sherberg after you left? And the truth is that Sherberg slipped a bit, and the expectations slipped a little bit, because the person who took over from me probably just didn't get the kind of sophisticated kind of insights in and around that, the importance of strong and smart. But what was most profoundly important was that despite the slippage, the community was outraged because they had enough of the kind of strong and smart school to understand that they deserved this, you know.
Yeah.
And even more important than that was that other Aboriginal communities around Australia were looking on and saying, hey, if this can happen in Sherberg, we want it to happen in our school. And so the kind of stronger, smarter philosophy is sustained at a community level in Sherberg, in the sense that community demanded it, and now Sherberg is back on track, and that it's been picked up by other communities across Australia in all sorts of schools.
Yeah.
And people are running with the stronger, smarter philosophy, which has been really, really positive. You asked me about, on the question of leaving QUT, look, it's a complex one, but it's one that that's pretty straightforward from my perspective. We just had a difference of opinion about what were appropriate governance arrangements that enabled us to have autonomy and what were adequate arrangements in terms of being able to deliver on the very important notion of financial transparency and disclosure. Inside the university that we were hosted by, we were an organisation that attracted large amounts of government dollars, and the perception was that I was in control of all of those dollars. The reality was quite different. And I did get to a point where I'd felt morally compromised, and, you know, if I couldn't have that full level of financial transparency and disclosure, then it was never going to be a circumstance which was considered adequate. So we agreed to disagree, and it became obvious that I needed to take the institute out of that university and set it up independently. with a constitution that ensures that the board is majority Aboriginal people, so that we are in control of the activities we engage in, so that we can have a level of financial transparency and disclosure in which we can say, we can articulate every dollar and every cent that's come in and every dollar and every cent that's gone out and what's been achieved with that. Something that I've talked about consistently for a very long time.
Strong and Smart as a philosophy is still relevant?
It's absolutely relevant, and I think its relevance will exist for some time. You know that we're still confronted by challenges in which young Aboriginal people coming through school, you know, we have to get in there and we have to mix it with every other Australian child, and that means we have to work hard in schools and strive for the kind of education outcomes that other Australians would consider acceptable to them. We have to get into universities, we have to get into jobs, we have to hold our own place in a modern society and any society throughout the world, but not ever at the expense of our sense of cultural identity. So we need to be smart and we need to be strong.
Chris Sara speaking with Rico Adran, and his book Good Morning, Mr. Sara is published by UQP. This is Away, 21 years on air here on RN. I'm Daniel Browning.